From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
About 100 meters, you know, far away from my house, they find soldiers from them, ask her husband to stop the car. He stopped the car and they start shooting. It's about 30-40 shooting in the car, and she was shooting in the head and the chest. She was died right away.
A 21-year-old Palestinian-American is shot and killed by Israeli soldiers in Ramallah with her 9-month-old baby on her lap. Today, we'll speak to her sister and her cousin, who live in Brooklyn, New York. Yesterday, we spoke with her father, who lives in Ramallah. As food supplies dwindle on the occupied territories, Israelis and Palestinians make a human chain across the Ramallah border to hand over food and medicine. They're attacked by the Israeli army. And protests from the Arab states to the United States. Tens of thousands take to the streets in Lebanon and Egypt, while Americans protest billions of dollars in U.S. military aid to Israel. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Scores of tanks and armored vehicles broke into Nablus on Wednesday night and encircled three nearby refugee camps while Palestinians resisted with rifles and grenades. A 53-year-old woman was killed in the initial Israeli thrust into the city, many others injured. Witnesses in the northern city of Jenin said helicopter gunships and tanks are attacking a nearby refugee camp, destroying houses and starting fires. In Bethlehem, some 200 Palestinians remain holed up in the Church of the Nativity, where Jesus Christ is believed to have been born. They are besieged by Israeli soldiers outside. Israeli troops fired pepper gas at journalists trying to reach the area. A Reuters correspondent said one soldier told the group of more than 30 journalists to turn back, quote, or we will use everything we have against you. We turn now to Kristen Schur, who is in the Al-Aza refugee camp just inside Bethlehem. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kristen.
Thank you.
Kristen is an international solidarity movement activist, one of the what are called internationalistas who have gone to the occupied territories to bear witness. What's happening where you are?
There is 2 to 3 days' worth of food left in Al-Aza refugee camp. Spirits are getting a little bit low. We've been shelled by tanks all afternoon. Five internationals were able to escort a man and his daughter with leukemia to the hospital for her treatment. We were able to fill 2 prescriptions, but were unable to get simple medicines such as an aspirin. Due to the curfew, all of the pharmacies are closed.
What have you heard about what's happening at the Church of the Nativity? We're hearing differing reports. The Israeli government is saying that the soldiers have not moved in, though they have surrounded it. We're hearing other reports that a door was broken in.
I'm hearing the same conflicting reports that you are. It's hard for us to get information now. Several people tried to get to the site but were unable to. They were tear gassed by Israeli soldiers as they got closer to Manger Square. I have heard that the soldiers have gotten inside the Church of the Nativity and have also heard that they've just surrounded it.
Kristen,
we don't know yet what's going on.
Kristen Schur reporting to us from Al-Aza refugee camp in Bethlehem. In Lebanon, 10,000 people took to the streets, tried to charge the heavily guarded U.S. embassy. Security forces used batons, tear gas, and water cannon to drive them back. Dozens were injured. Meanwhile, there are signs that a second front could be opened in the Middle East conflict. The Israeli army and the Lebanese-based guerrilla group Hezbollah exchanged fire yesterday. The Syrian president announced the redeployment of 20,000 Syrian troops in Lebanon. We'll have a report from Beirut later in the program. Egypt announced it's suspending diplomatic contacts with Israel. Egypt will only maintain diplomatic channels, which could directly help Palestinians, they say. The announcement came as tens of thousands of students launched a sixth day of demonstrations across the country demanding the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador. Egypt is Israel's largest and most important ally in the Middle East. In Athens, Greece, about 4,000 people chanting Sharon, murderer, and American murderers of the people demonstrated outside the Israeli embassy as Greece demanded an immediate end to the military offensive in Palestinian areas. Hundreds of Turkish leftists protested in front of Israel's consulate in Istanbul in a second day of protests against Turkey's close military ally. Malaysia's opposition urged Islamic States to sever diplomatic ties with Israel and called on the UN to indict Ariel Sharon as a war criminal. Hundreds of Muslim students rallied in Indonesian cities to demand the Israeli military withdrawal from the Palestinian territories. India appealed to Israel to withdraw from Palestinian cities. The Vatican sharply criticized Israel. It said Pope John Paul, quote, rejects unjust conditions and humiliations imposed on the Palestinian people, as well as the reprisals and revenge attacks, which do nothing but feed the sense of frustration and hatred, unquote. The European Commissioner urged withdrawal of Israeli troops from Palestinian territory, and EU foreign ministers dispatched two senior envoys to Israel and Palestinian territories. In uncharacteristically blunt language, this from the Financial Times, Romano Prodi, European Commissioner President, said it's clear, quote, mediation efforts have failed and we need new mediation. In Washington, pressure is mounting on Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, to upgrade his personal involvement in the ceasefire talks by flying to the region. The United States, yesterday, fighting at the United Nations to derail a new Palestinian resolution calling for the immediate withdrawal of Israel from the West Bank town of Ramallah, using its veto to quash the text would be politically untenable and would give Israel carte blanche in the military campaign in the occupied territories, diplomats said, but agreeing to the resolution would further throw Washington's confused policy on the crisis into the spotlight. The French prime minister said an international buffer force should be sent to the Middle East to help establish a ceasefire. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said yesterday, quote, the president's position remains clear. It's what he's been saying for days, that in the wake of the suicide bombings and the attacks that took place in Israel, he understands and respects Israel's right to defend herself, unquote. Meanwhile, it emerged yesterday that U.S. Envoy General Anthony Zinni's proposed so-called ceasefire plan would allow Israel to continue attacks on Palestinian presidential buildings, security headquarters, and prisons. The plan also dropped a requirement that Israel should not attack innocent civilian targets. Furious Palestinian negotiators have released a copy of the document, which General Zinni presented last week. Israel treated the document as an ultimatum, demanding Arafat sign it as a condition of being allowed to attend the Arab summit in Beirut, but he refused. Meanwhile, several bills have been introduced on Capitol Hill to impose sanctions on the Palestinians and further isolate Yasser Arafat. The House is considering a bill that would empower the president to close the Palestinians' Washington office, designate the Palestinian Authority and related groups as terrorist organizations, deny U.S. visas to top Palestinian officials, and eliminate some forms of aid to the West Bank and Gaza. That bill was introduced last year by New York Democrat Gary Ackerman. Virginia Republican Congressmember Eric Cantor is sponsoring a bill that would prohibit any federal agency from directly or indirectly assisting the Palestinian Authority or related groups. In the Senate, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein and Republican Mitch McConnell are drafting a bill that would deny Yasser Arafat a U.S. visa, restrict operations of the Palestinian office in Washington, and seize any assets held by Arafat in this country. McConnell said the measure is likely to be attached to the foreign operations spending bill for next year if it's not approved separately before that. In Afghanistan, U.S. coalition forces have come under fresh attack from Taliban and al-Qaeda forces. The attack in Paktia province Wednesday came more than 2 weeks after the end of the U.S.-led Operation Anaconda. The U.S. claims that hundreds of Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters were killed during Anaconda, but very few bodies have been discovered, and there have been persistent but unconfirmed reports that hundreds of people managed to slip through mountain passes in Pakistan.
Goes by and still the children cry. Come on, put a little love in your heart. If you want the world to know that you won't let hatred grow, come on, put a little love in your heart. And I know the world,
I know the world
will be better than us. And I feel the world,
I feel the world.
put a little love in your heart. You're listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. The massive assault on the city of Nablus last night is just the latest step in Israel's methodical offensive against the Palestinians. Israeli forces have taken over six major West Bank towns and cities: Ramallah, Qalqilya, Jenin, Tulkarm, Bethlehem, Nablus. The towns of Jericho and Hebron remain the last islands of Palestinian control. Thousands of Palestinians have been arrested. Countless of others have been killed and injured. Yesterday on Democracy Now!, we spoke to the father of Sarayda Saleh. She is 21 years old. She's a Palestinian American. She was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers in Ramallah last Friday. She was holding her 9-month-old baby in her lap. And as the group American Muslims for Global Peace and Justice discovered, Sarayda Saleh was also a U.S. citizen born at George Washington Hospital in Washington, D.C. Sarayda's father, Farhan Mohammed Saleh, told Democracy Now! That Israeli soldiers asked Sarayda's husband to stop the car, which he was driving in with Sarayda and her baby. He said they shot Sarayda in the head and chest. Her husband was also shot repeatedly, but he and the baby survived the attack. With the Ramallah hospital morgue overflowing and Israeli soldiers preventing anyone from reaching the cemetery, Farhan Mohammed Saleh was forced to bury his daughter in the hospital parking lot alongside dozens of other Palestinians. The Office of Consular Affairs at the State Department told Democracy Now! On Tuesday they were aware that Sarayda is a U.S. citizen, was a U.S. citizen, but did not plan to release a statement or take any action. We asked a State Department spokesperson to appear on today's program, but they declined. Instead, today we are joined by two of Sarayda's U.S.-based relatives. Her sister, Samar Saleh, joins us on the telephone from her Brooklyn home where she's watching her two children. Sarayda's cousin, Suhad Sarsour, joins us in the Firehouse studio. And we welcome you to Democracy Now! Suhad Sarsour, what do you understand about what happened to your sister?
She's my cousin. And I don't know exactly what happened because from the stories, each time my aunt, she tries to finish her story, she bursts out crying, so she doesn't finish it for us. But she was in her car going to her parents' house. She wants to go away from the fire, from the bullets and stuff. On her way there, she was sitting with her son in her lap, and her husband was driving. They started shooting. They didn't even know who was in the car or whatever, and they kept telling him, stop shooting. They stopped the car so they get the point and stop shooting, but they kept on shooting until she died right away. Her husband said that she died while she was defending him and her son.
Samar Saleh, has the U.S. Embassy or has the U.S. State Department contacted you? You are the sister of Sarayda.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Have they spoken to you?
Hi. What I have to say, it's so hard when I think I'm not going to see my sister again. Because I didn't see her like 2 years ago.
When did Sarayda go back to Ramallah?
My father sent us back to Palestine, like, when we were, I was, 5 years, she was 4 years.
But you came back to the United States?
Yeah, I got married and I came back with my husband.
And Sarayda stayed in Ramallah?
Yeah. Because she was studying there.
How did you hear that Sarayda was killed?
I was watching the news and the night, and I heard there's a lady was killed in Ain Misbah, the area where my parents live. Then I feel something wrong with my family. I don't know. It's from God. But the next day in the morning, I called my family, and my mom started crying. Then I told her, I knew something happened for you. What's wrong? Then she started crying, and she hung up Then I called again, and my brother answered me, and he told me that my sister was killed.
Has the U.S. State Department contacted you?
I don't know exactly, but who told them?
But you here in the United States, has the U.S. government gotten in touch with you as Sarita's sister?
Yes.
They have spoken to you?
Yes, there's a guy called us from the department.
And what did he say?
About what?
What did the U.S. government official say?
Nothing. They didn't say anything. They just called, and my husband told them to call my father in Palestine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, then they called him to see if they could take him to the hospital to see her and bury her body. But he waiting for them, and nobody showed up.
He described that to us on the telephone that he spoke with the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, that they said they would send someone, but they didn't, and he has continued to now not receiving. I'm looking at the New York Times today. It says the State Department says it has received a report that an American woman was shot and killed Friday in Ramallah, apparently by Israeli military forces. The woman, identified as Sarita Farhan Saleh, was shot while riding in a car with her husband and 9-month-old baby, according to a State Department spokeswoman, Susan Pittman. The victim's husband was injured, the baby unharmed. No further details were available. And they did acknowledge to us at Democracy Now! That they knew that she had died and that she was an American citizen. We're also joined on the telephone by Hussein Ibish, Communications Director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. We were very struck by the story, Hussein Ibish, as we heard it. I mean, more than 1,000 Palestinians, more than 400 Israelis have died in the last year. But when an American dies, there is a tremendous amount of tension in the U.S. press when an American dies in Israel or the occupied territories. Yet when we read the report from American Muslims for Global Peace and Justice that they had so clearly documented, and they said that they had sent out this in emails and faxes and press release to all the press and got no response, we started to wonder what was going on. Is it because Sarita Saleh is an Arab American, a Palestinian American, that this was getting so little attention and the State Department refused to respond? Hussein Ibish.
I think, Amy, really, I really wish I could give you a different answer, but the plain truth is there's no doubt about it. There's absolutely no question. And first of all, this ghastly story, this horrible story that we've heard, really is so typical of what's been happening to Palestinians across the board for the past 18 months. And that's why you've got this figure of 1,280-something Palestinians who have died, most of them unarmed civilians. And right now, apologists for Israel are running all over this country saying they all collateral damage, they were all in the way of chasing terrorists, they were all, you know, it's all an accident, which is preposterous, trying to cloak Israel's actions in some sort of moral sheen. Now, as far as the overall pattern of Arab Americans being, first of all, treated this way by the Israeli occupation forces in the occupied territories and the reaction of the U.S. press and State Department, it's part of a very familiar pattern to us. I'm afraid that this lady is certainly not the first Arab American to get killed in the Intifada. In the early stages, several Arab Americans were shot in their homes by Israeli troops, and again, we pushed the issue very hard back in November and December of 2000 when the Intifada was just starting, the conflict was just starting, and we got really no response from the State Department and no interest from the consulate or the embassy in Israel or the consulate in Jerusalem, and we got no interest from the press here whatsoever. I think you're absolutely right. that when, let's be frank here, when Jewish Americans or non-Arab Americans in Israel or in the occupied territories get killed, they receive a great deal of attention, and that's fine and proper. But it seems as if the American government and the American press have essentially accepted the Israeli practice of regarding Arab Americans in Israel and Palestine as Palestinians, and then subjecting them to the same double standard and secondary treatment and disregard that Palestinians are treated with, both in terms of the treatment they receive and the interest that the U.S. government and U.S. press has in that mistreatment.
I think we see also what a difference media activism can make. I know yesterday that the State Department got hundreds of calls from listeners. We also were contacted by CNN, NBC, MSNBC, as was Americans for the organization that has really broken the story, gathered the details for it, American Muslims for Global Peace. CNN and NBC called them, MSNBC called us, and there might be some interest, perhaps because of the pressure, but what difference it makes when there is a media that deals with human life, whether it's Israeli or Palestinian, equally.
Well, I think you make a very good point here, Amy, and I think there are two factors. One is the activism. The other is the fact that this is an element of the big story of the day. And, you know, if she had been killed when there wasn't a giant offensive going on and where this was considered, say, one out of 20 major stories or something like that, I mean the whole conflict, then we've seen in the past that it's been very tough even with activism to do that. But I think that your listeners who called have made a big difference. And obviously it's going to be a factor. It's going to be a major factor. Grassroots activism is always incredibly helpful in almost every situation. Let me say something else, which is, you know, that the U.S. government knows that the Israelis have not been regarding Arab Americans as Americans, that they refuse routinely to allow Arab Americans to leave Israel in the occupied territories on their American passports, that they've told hundreds, if not thousands, of Arab Americans that they will not recognize their American citizenship and force these people to get Palestinian travel documents before they're allowed to leave, and that Arab Americans have been arrested in the occupied territories, that dozens, scores, if not hundreds, really, over the last few years have been arrested. And when they're arrested, they are treated like Palestinians, which means that they are subjected to martial law, not Israeli civil law, which is applied to Israeli citizens and all other foreigners. It means that they're subjected to torture. It means that they are given military tribunals with secret evidence, and they've, you know, received lengthy prison sentences under these totally unacceptable conditions. And we have been working on this this racism, frankly, with the U.S. government for a long time, saying that U.S. government needs to ensure that American citizens of all ethnicities are provided with equal protection, and that the U.S. should not accept Israeli racism that deems Arab Americans to be either non-Americans or secondary Americans or something like that. And we really, really have not made a lot of progress with that. So this is all part of a much broader pattern of the government and the media here accepting what is an extension of Israeli apartheid, not just to Palestinians, but also to Palestinian and other Arab Americans as well. And it's totally unacceptable. It's just got to stop.
I understand that the family of Sarada Saleh, because much of her family is here in the United States, may be also holding a news conference, which would put further pressure on the State Department. Suhad Sarsour, cousin of Sarada Saleh, is that the case?
Yeah, everyone. They've been contacting people. My cousins in Chicago and Detroit and Washington, D.C., they want as many people as they can to talk about her and what happened exactly.
Mm-hmm. You have your two daughters with you. How old are they?
One's almost four and one's almost two.
And their cousin, have they ever met? Their nine-month-old cousin,
no.
Sarita's son?
Never. We've been here a year ago. She had her baby after we came here.
And you, like Sarita, were born in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And went back to Ramallah?
Yeah, to live there after when I was 12, and I came back a year ago after I got married.
Mm-hmm. As we wrap up, we will continue to follow this story. I understand that Sarita's uncle lives in Washington, D.C., and is working with the group that first broke this story, American Muslims for Global Peace and Justice. What are you asking for? What are you demanding?
It's the least thing we can do to maybe we could stop, try to help stop people, the killing and stuff. It's hard. She's gone and she's not in, she's gone and she died and she's not in pain. It's her mom and everyone after her. How's her mom going to start raising the little boy again? Each time she looks at him, she's going to remember her daughter. They couldn't even bury her the right way.
And her husband?
And her husband. He's not even been married to her for 2 years, and look, now he doesn't even have a wife no more. He's going to always remember how she died in front of him, in front of his own eyes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in. Suhad Sarsour, cousin of Sarita Saleh, Samar Saleh on the line with us from Brooklyn, New York, sister of Sarita, 21-year-old Palestinian-American who was killed by Israeli soldiers last Friday in Ramallah, where she lived with her husband and her 9-month-old child. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we are going to go to Beirut. Thousands of people protested there. We will go to Ramallah and Jerusalem. There were thousands of Israeli Jews and Palestinians who formed a human chain to try to get food into Ramallah. They were beaten back by Israeli forces. And then we're going to look at support for the Israeli military here at home and a growing divestiture movement that is happening beginning on college campuses to push the United States government to stop supporting the Israeli military in this time of the assault on the occupied territories. Stay with us.
Put off your faces, death. Poor day is over. Smoothly gesturing stars, clever to persuade, even silence.
Patricia Barber, interpreting E. Cummings' poem, Put Off Your Faces, Death, For the Day is Over. You are listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. In Lebanon, 10,000 people took to the streets and tried to charge the heavily guarded U.S. embassy. Security forces used batons, tear gas, and water cannon to drive them back. Dozens were injured. We turn now to Lana Al-Khalil, who is founder of FIST, Fight Israeli State Terror, in Beirut. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. Good to hear your voice.
Can you describe what happened?
Basically, as I'm speaking to you, I'm actually lying down in my bed because of the extent of police brutality that was used against us. I'm unable to use my legs at this point as they're fully bruised. Basically, as you mentioned, 10,000 of us marched towards the U.S. Embassy with very peaceful intention, simply to declare our demands, which are, in the most simplistic terms, end the onslaught, do not give the green light, and do not call massacre.
Are you still with us, Lana? Lana just somehow fell off the line. We are going to continue, though, with our next guest. Today is the 7th day of the most recent invasion of the occupied territories. For a week, its cities and villages have been cut off from the world by a wall of tanks, troops, and helicopters. A military curfew makes movement almost impossible. Food is scarce. Medical supplies have basically run out. Yesterday, the Israelis turned off the water supply for all of Ramallah. Thousands of Israeli Jews and Arabs, though, yesterday, marched to the border of Ramallah with trucks full of food and medicine. As they approached the checkpoint, Israeli police fired tear gas and began hitting protesters with batons. Some 20 demonstrators were injured. Among the injured were three Israeli Knesset members. Meanwhile, the phones of the Jerusalem-based Palestinian Counseling Center were ringing nonstop. The center is one of the few mental health facilities still able to provide services to Palestinians in the occupied territories. The calls are coming in fast and furious. I need milk for my two-month-old baby. I need medicine because I have diabetes. I'm alone, trapped in a restaurant in Ramallah, and Israeli snipers are on the rooftop. Some of the things that are coming in to the staff. In a minute, we're going to go to the founder of that Palestinian Counseling Center. Siham Rashid is on the line with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. By the way, I am one of the employees here, even though it's nice if I would have been a founder. but I'm a counselor here at the center.
Can you tell us what's happening?
Yes. We are still receiving literally tons of calls by the hour. Very much the same requests. Palestinian families are requesting basic necessities such as bread and milk for the children. And as you mentioned earlier, the water supplies were cut off. And until now, as we are speaking, they have not been fixed. So you have huge populations of Palestinians who are not receiving water as well. And we also just received, we're trying to coordinate activities from the callers with medical personnel that are in Ramallah, in Bethlehem area, in Tulkarim area. And we just recently called the Palestinian Red Crescent Societies, who informed us that they and the Red Cross and UNRWA have all halted all of their activities in the West Bank areas because their personnel have continued to be shot at. The Palestinian Red Crescent Societies have also lost many ambulances, which were destroyed by Israeli tanks, and UNRWA, which is primarily it's a UN refugee program. They've been trying to get food supplies into Ramallah, Bethlehem areas, and they've also been prevented. And some other personnel have also been humiliated by the Israelis. So for us, this came as a shock, more frustration, obviously. Because these were the three main bodies that were preventing any kind of medical assistance and food assistance for the Palestinians who were confined to their homes, very much prisons in the occupied territories.
We're also joined by Hagit Gerziv, who is co-founder of New Profile, which is the movement for the civilization of Israeli society, speaking on the phone to us from Tel Aviv. You were one of the lead organizing groups in yesterday's march.
That's right.
Can you talk about the scene at the checkpoint?
Well, there were around 3,000 people there. There are two teams of us negotiating with a policeman about letting the food truck and medicine supply pass by. And suddenly they started to shoot at us tear gas at the crowd and beating. And they didn't even warn us that they want us to the demonstration to disperse. They were very brutal. They did it twice. They did it once, and then we come back, and then they did it again for no reason, really. They just gave us the regular treatment that they give the Palestinians, probably milder than they did to them.
And what was the reaction of the Israeli soldiers to you as Israeli Jews who were there trying to form this human chain to get food and medical supplies into Ramallah?
Well,
You know, the soldiers at the checkpoints are just pins in the game. They're just getting orders. They do what they're being told. Once they're in the game, they sort of lose their human touch. They do terrible things. This is not the worst thing that they do. I heard you report some of them. They don't let women in labor pass the checkpoint. They do things that are just... amazing how inhuman they can be. So why wouldn't finally they did let the trucks pass, and our four trucks passed to Ramallah with medical supply and food, but after a lot of negotiation. But in general, there is sort of an agreement in Israel here that this war is necessary, but that this is a military set of mind that a lot of Israelis have, and of course our leaders have this set of mind that only war is a solution, and the war is no solution for anything.
Siham Rashid, it was women who led this protest, trying to get the food and medicine in, thousands, Palestinian and Israeli Jewish. Can you talk about the significance of this woman-led movement?
Yes, I was there yesterday, actually. It was great. I think it was that one time that I can actually smile, because I was really happy. I was very, very happy to see the Israeli peace movement out there. I know that they've tried to have many activities in the past, but for this, this was just beautiful because it was Israeli women, Palestinian women, foreign women, as well as men, of course. It was a beautiful, beautifully mixed group, and we were there basically trying to send out one message that exactly like, what's her name? The woman who just spoke, I'm sorry, I didn't catch her name.
Hagit Gerziv.
Hadid, I'm sorry. Just like Hadid said, we were basically trying to get the message across that no to war, no to starvation, and it was very well organized. I think the people very much kept intact with the message that was being sent out. And like Hadid said, I mean, I was one of the people up front as well. And I have a very bad case of asthma. Yesterday was the first time in my life I really thought that I felt I was going to die. I mean, yesterday was the first time in my life I really thought I was facing death. And I think the only thing that really kept me strong was the fact that I kept thinking of the phone calls that we're receiving. And I was telling myself, see, yeah, people's homes, you know, Palestinian people's homes are being, you know, torn apart. Palestinian children don't even have access to school or food, or, you know, you have to be strong. And I don't know how I reached a certain area where I just threw myself on the floor, and I just found a lot of people around me, and I couldn't breathe because I have a very bad asthma situation. And I know this was a very peaceful demonstration or rally that I really didn't expect for tear gas to be thrown at us. Right into the crowds, right in front of us, you know, right beside us. And, you know, for the first time in my life, really, I felt like, you know, I didn't know what to do. And, you know, first time, I think that kind of fear really encompassed me. And I was not being shot at by bullets. This was tear gas, but I could not breathe.
We have been joined back on the phone by Lana Al-Khalil, who is a founder of Fight Israeli State Terror, known as FIST, and she's in Beirut, where there were thousands who protested yesterday in front of the U.S. Embassy. Did you hear about this protest of Jews and Palestinians trying to get into Ramallah yesterday, Lana, in Beirut?
Yes, of course, we did hear about it. Usually, because the city is in a state of protest, there are thousands of people on the streets every day, so we rely on the time when we do come back home to actually turn on the news and catch up and find out what's been happening with our brothers and sisters in Palestine. And we did hear about this protest, and we did hear, not to our surprise at all, that another peaceful protest was received by the Israeli army by their usage of tear gas and all the other weapons that they do use against unarmed civilian protesters. At the same time, on the Beirut front, we were about 10,000 of us in front of the American embassy. As I said before, I was cut off, declaring that we will stand for U.S. support of Israeli brutality no longer.
We were not only met by tear gas and water cannons, but also rocks. The Lebanese army was throwing rocks at us. And in a matter of 1 minute, as I was treating someone, a boy, in an ambulance, in a matter of 1 minute, about 6 to 7 other injuries came, their head gushing with blood from rocks that had hit them on their head. It was a very violent process, and most of this violence was not coming from the protesters, but the army. When confronting the army and asking them how they could turn against the Lebanese people and use such violence against us for a cause that we should all stand united upon, which is the cause of Palestine, one of the army men replied that he's actually protecting us. As far as I know, from this soldier, the American embassy issued a statement saying any protester that is seen 30 meters from the embassy will be shot immediately by the embassy security. So it's very interesting, Amy, to actually understand the situation as the U.S., supposedly the beacon of democracy and free speech, is willing to shoot anybody who is there to criticize their foreign policy and to say no to the support of the Israeli massacre.
Lana Al-Khalil, we only have 30 seconds. With you from Beirut, a quick question. Tents of Resistance campaign that is being organized, can you explain what it is?
Yes, very quickly, we are sending out an invitation to all people of conscience in the world who want to protest directly Israel's continuous onslaught on the Palestinians to join us here in Beirut. We're setting up tents on the borders with Israel where we'll be met with Israelis protesting from the inside. And these tents are going to go up on all the borders of Israel around the Arab world and internationally in front of Israeli embassies. And it is basically a symbolic siege of the Israeli state by the people, and we're asking it to be followed by a boycott of Israeli goods politically and economically. Anybody who is interested in joining us here in Beirut, please send us an email. Our email address is Tents of Resistance. That's one word, Tents of Resistance, at altern.org.
I want to thank you for being with us, Lana Al-Khalil, talking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. Finally, back in Tel Aviv, speaking to Hagit Gerziv, co-founder of New Profile. Yours is an organization that has been joining with Palestinian women. You also have been taking on the issue of Israeli militarism and how it's bolstered by the United States. In our next segment, we're going to talk precisely about that issue. What is the level of support? How are you organizing against it in Israel?
Well, first of all, we try to get into the public opinion to understand that the state of, since we're so highly militarized, this is a fuel to the war. All the American weapons that comes here is a fuel to this war. And as long as our structure in society is militarized, this war is never going to end. We support conscientious objector. We support political objector, people who don't go to the army because they refuse to be part of this game. We give them information about their rights. We support them when they're being in jail. We try to work against the militarization of education that is very strong here. We call to stop U.S. aid because most of U.S. aid, 85% of U.S. aid, goes to military. Again, this feeds the conflict. Actually, Israel is sort of an American military base. United States is really holding the Israeli army, and we think this should stop. And we think that tax money, the money that goes into military in this zone, could make wonderful peace if you put the same amount of money into building people's life and livelihood. That would change the situation.
The type of weapons that are being used in Israel that are coming from the United States?
The type of weapon that comes to Israel, the United States is really using Israel and this conflict here as a field test for the new weapon, the Apache helicopters, the F-16. We use it in ways the Americans don't, and we give them back the information, and they can make the weapons more destructive. It's a whole game that we need to stop it. And the United States is providing a military weapon not only to Israel, it's to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, to Kuwait. The whole zone is a big arsenal of weapons.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Hagit Gerziv, co-founder of New Profile, the movement for the civilization of Israeli society, speaking to us from Tel Aviv, as well as Siham Rashid, counselor at the Palestinian Counseling Center in Jerusalem. They both were part of the human chain as they tried to get medical supplies and food into Ramallah yesterday. Thousands of women, supported by some men, on the border with the occupied territories. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Until the philosophy that holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's not only Arabs and Palestinians and Israelis who are protesting the Israeli invasion of the occupied territories. People in this country are also gearing up to protest the U.S. support for Israel. Despite the mainstream media's portrayal of the Bush administration as disengaged from the conflict, the U.S. could hardly be more involved. The U.S. gives more aid to Israel than to any other country in the world, over $3 billion. With that money, Israel buys U.S. Stinger missiles, F-16 jets, Apache, Black Hawk helicopters. All have been used against civilians. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, GE all sell arms to Israel. Mark Lance is the founding member of Sustain, Stop U.S. Tax Aid to Israel Now. Can you talk about these specifics?
Sure, Amy. I mean, I want to say that, first of all, Sustain is built around the idea that there's a fundamental moral point here. Probably the great moral lesson of the Holocaust is that massive evil cannot take place without the support of all those who allow business as usual to go on. And the reality is that you, I, Hussein Ibish, every American who pays taxes supports this occupation because our money goes to Israel. Israel uses that money to buy weapons produced in this country, and those weapons are used to carry out the ethnic cleansing, the murders, to support the occupation. The level of support has been roughly constant since about 1969. It's gone up a bit. The percentage of aid that's devoted to military is rising rapidly right now. And the U.S. has been an absolute and constant supporter of this occupation. Whatever it says in terms of negotiations, as long as we're sending the weapons, providing the support, providing diplomatic cover in the United Nations, we're all complicit in this massacre, and we all as Americans have a responsibility to stop it.
Marty Rosenbluth is also on the line with us, country specialist for Israel, the Occupied Territories, and the Palestinian Authority for Amnesty International USA. You have the U.S. giving Israel more than $3 billion, but does it go actually to Israel or simply to support the weapons manufacturers here?
Well, I mean, let me just shift the conversation a bit because, I mean, I think that the U.S. government in their statement that they will not criticize Israel because Israel has the right to defend itself just flies in the face of international law. I mean, okay, Israel has the right to defend itself, but they have to respect human rights in the process, and Israel cannot target civilians, especially not with using U.S. weapons, which is a violation of U.S. law. So, I mean, for Ari Fleischer to get on TV and say that they're not going to criticize what Israel is doing in the occupied territories because Israel has the right to self-defense, I mean, that's very similar to the argument that Palestinian armed groups use in attacking Israeli civilians, that we have the right to defend ourselves, so therefore anything goes.
Can you talk about the 75% rule?
Well, yes. I mean, under the arms sales provisions to Israel, under U.S. military aid to Israel, 75% of that money needs to be spent in buying weapons from U.S. arms suppliers. So, I mean, that ends up being a huge, massive subsidy to the U.S. arms industry. But from Amnesty's concerns is that the Arms Export Control Act says very specifically, very clearly, that these weapons can only be used for defensive purposes. And if there's evidence that U.S. weapons are being used to commit human rights violations, that these weapon sales have to cease. At the very least, the Arms Export Control Act requires the U.S. government to investigate in situations where there is evidence of human rights violations, whether or not human rights violations have been committed. And so far, not only has the U.S. government failed to investigate, but has even stated publicly that they will not investigate whether these weapons have been used in violation of U.S. law. So Amnesty International has called for U.S. weapons transfers and sales to Israel to be suspended until such an investigation can take place.
We're also joined on the line by Robert Chlala, who is a third-year undergraduate at University of California, Berkeley, member of the Justice and Palestine Group. Can you talk about the divestment campaign that's beginning in Berkeley?
Getting the University of California Regents Board to pull out any investments in the State of Israel, which directly linked to military technology. And there's about $5 to $6 billion out of the $19 billion UC Regents portfolio, which go directly to companies that do direct business in military technology in Israel. I mean, this includes GE's $600 million investment, which goes through the propulsion systems, which are for the Apache helicopter systems, and things like Nokia's jamming technology, which are used on with IDF technology for raids. And the focus of the divestment campaign has been kind of a political education to show students here in the community about their kind of investments that we make on a daily basis to the State of Israel and towards direct violation of human rights and international standards. And it's also been focused on getting like a direct action and other campaign to get the university to actually pull its money out. And it's been modeled on previous things that have been done in the South Africa divestment campaign.
I know you just had a National Day of Action where 1,000 people came out, a conference on this issue. What companies are you targeting?
We're targeting 19 companies, including GE, Nokia, Hewlett-Packard, Time Warner, IBM and Microsoft, and a few other companies.
Mark Lance, can you talk about what they make?
Sure. I mean, they make, I mean, all the major defense contractors that make these weapons are implicated in Israel. I mean, Bell contributes to components of attack helicopters, software for F-15s. You've got United Technologies, Sikorsky Division, that produces Black Hawk helicopters. Lockheed Martin, that produces a huge range of of weapons. GE, as was mentioned, produces engines for Apaches and other kinds of weapons. And as you were suggesting before, it's very important to realize, in terms of the political support for this continued U.S. support for Israel, everyone talks about the Israel lobby, but there's another. This military lobby is another extremely important piece of that. And so the idea that students are targeting these corporations is an extremely important moment in the resistance movement.
Vincent Lloyd is on with us, a junior at Princeton University, one of the lead organizers of the school's divestment campaign. What are you doing there?
Similar to the Berkeley campaign, we're trying to follow up and make the analogy with South Africa, saying that just as Princeton University was investing in South Africa and supporting that regime that was oppressing millions of people and violating human rights and violating international law, Princeton ought to dissociate itself from the Israeli regime while those things are going on and while the occupation is taking place. We've been getting a lot of support from a broad group of students on campus. We've been getting more than 100 students signing a petition every week, faculty members, even faculty members who are supporting the South African campaign. The chairman of the history department, Robert Tigner, was the first one to sign on to this campaign, who was very supportive of the South African campaign. We have Jewish students involved. A whole broad range of students are trying to stop the Princeton support of the Israeli occupation.
Mark Lance, you're also organizing for April 20th, a major anti-war mobilization in Washington that also coincides with Ariel Sharon coming to Washington, D.C.
That's right. On that weekend, there'll be sort of major anti-war protests connecting with militarism in Colombia and Latin America. There's the IMF World Bank will be in town, and there's going to be protests about economic exploitation, and Ariel Sharon will be in town. I mean, we've got a real axis of evil here. We'll be joining with other movements in solidarity with other struggles throughout the world, with a Palestinian contingent. We'll be educating people about the economic connections, along with many other groups. I mean, this is not by any means just a sustained event. There's a huge range of groups that are working on this. And on Monday the 22nd, there will be a major there'll be press conference, street theater, demonstration, and civil disobedience against the current attacks, against the occupation, and demanding an end to aid to Israel.
Robert Chalala at University of California, you mentioned corporations that are not weapons traditionally we think of as weapons manufacturers. Why these?
A lot of them do work that does provide other kind of background work, like Hewlett Packard provides money for the Technion Institute, which is high-tech weapons research and indirect involvement. And Time Warner has a 30% investment policy and a CNN affiliate, and we believe that the media is just as complicit in this kind of work as the military direct involvement. And the rest are generally IT and like United Technologies and Ericsson and the rest of these. And IBM Microsoft, again, provides the kind of information technology and general support for the IDF that are basically equivalent to military technology support.
Mark Lance, the Carlyle Group, 11th largest weapons manufacturer in this country, former President George Bush, a big part of his, James Baker, et cetera, all profiting from what's going on right now, whether it's Afghanistan, a bombing of Iraq, or the occupied territories.
Well, of course they are, and the power of this is that there's a sort of confluence of interests. I mean, there's U.S. uses of Israel, as the woman in Israel was talking about, as a military base in a region where we want to exploit the natural resources. There's the funding going to military corporations. There's, you know, there's a whole range of interests that are served by this kind of imperialist mentality that tries to militarize every sector of the world with an eye to keeping U.S. control over it.
We have to come to the end of the discussion. If people want to give out their website, Sustain, Mark Lance?
Sustaincampaign.org.
And if our guest from University of California, Robert Chalala?
www.justiceinpalestine.org.
Vincent Lloyd, Princeton University?
Princeton.edu/TildeSPEAC.
And Amnesty International's website?
www.amnesty.org.
I want to thank you all for being with us. I know there are major protests that are happening throughout the week, today at 5 in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., on Friday at Times Square and in front of the Israeli consulate in New York. We'll have all sorts of information on our website at democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Our email is mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We're broadcasting from Downtown Community Television here just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.